Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And now we conclude our February series with Anya Kamenetz, author of the book Generation Debt, plus the Generation Debt blog on Yahoo, her blog The Narrow Bridge, and she's a columnist for Fast Company. She's been on with us once a week this month to talk all things debt, including personal advice for some of you, plus the politics and some of the outrageous practices in the debt industry. And this being the last Thursday, it is the last time round. So, Anya, thanks for doing this with us. People have really been loving it and learning a lot.
Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate it.
And you've been very generous with your time answering some questions on our comments page even after the show. And you have an intriguing piece on Fast Company this week about a new model of borrowing or lending going by the name Uncrunch America. You call it pro-social lending or social network lending. Is this like Facebook for money?
You know, it actually is. One of the participants in this coalition lending club, they did start with a Facebook application. And the idea is that you'll be more likely to lend money to people that you know. And this peer-to-peer lending, it goes on with Prosper, lending club. People are actually pooling money. They're investing it out into a bunch of different people's loans. And it's so the money's coming from another person, not from a bank.
And you're right that this system has a holistic credit scoring model. How does that work?
Well, so the holistic credit scoring model is another way. There's another participant in this group that's offering capital to small businesses. And what they're doing is basically saying, we're not just going to look at your credit score, but we're going to look at your business and how the business is doing. So again, it's alternative means of capital. It's applying technology to the banking problem.
Now, of course, the idea of peer-to-peer lending sounds great if you're the borrower. But for peer-to-peer lending lenders, I mean, you know, we were just asking people for their moderate donations to the station. We're not banks with tons of money sitting around to loan. I'm not sure I trust my regular old peers with my regular old 401k money or whatever to lend out as an investment.
You know, it's really interesting, and obviously it gets back to the question of trust. You know, in this model, it's an investment model. So you're earning a percentage on your money. You want to diversify and lend to a lot of different people, not just one person. And you want to get as much information as you can about the people that you're lending to. So, you know, not just their credit score, but on these kinds of sites, you can post your picture, post a story. And very, very important, you can get your friends and family to sort of vouch for you and say, this is a good person.
Who do you actually recommend this for on the lender side?
On the lender side, I would say if, you know, and this is something I'm thinking about doing, if you have a little bit of money to invest, right, and it's a short-term time, you can buy a CD or you could buy, you could buy some stocks. It's not a great time to be in stocks right now. If you're looking at a 7 to 8% return over an 18-month, three-year period, and this is not your retirement fund. This is money on the side.
Yeah, sitting around, right, liquid.
This is an interesting kind of investment. It's an innovative investment.
You also sent us a note about some interesting ways for people with too much debt to manage their spending. One is to go all cash. The other is free websites like Gizio and Mint that help you track your spending. How do those websites work?
So I actually got some questions about this on your site. And, you know, Mint.com, I interviewed the founder when they were first starting out. He's a guy my age. He's 28 years old. And he said, you know, our generation never balanced a checkbook. We don't know how. And we don't really want to. And he collects people's information. So you give them your bank passwords. That's a big stumbling block for a lot of people. But once you get over that security, and he's got a lot of security safeguards, you can see all of your expenses in one place. They automatically track and categorize your expenses. I can see how much money I spent in restaurants last month, how much I spent at the Whole Foods, you know, and you can compare it to other New Yorkers. It's just an amazing way to feel like you're getting a handle on your finances.
So it's a feedback loop, and then you have to act responsibly with this new information that these folks are organizing for you.
Right. So budgeting, you know, it's not a magic tool. You have to do something with the information. One thing I really like about the services like Mint and Gizio is the automatic alerts. So they will send you a text message or an email if, hey, your balance is low, hey, you incurred a fee or a charge. I don't always sit down and go over my statement with a fine-tooth comb, but they've prompted me to do that more carefully.
And they do this for free, these websites?
So the business model is not proven yet, just like with Facebook and Twitter and all these wonderful Web 2.0 tools. They make money by advertising financial services on the site and by steering people to financial services. You know, what they can do is they know now how much you're earning on your CD or on your savings account, and they can say, hey, this bank has an offer that will save you more.
I'm still nervous. You vouch for their security?
I cannot. I am not a computer expert, but I think that, you know, it's not very – they use the same back end that's used by the banks. So if you're nervous about typing your password into Citibank, maybe you should be. Maybe you should be nervous about typing it into Mint as well.
And what's this about going all cash?
Well, so all cash is great for people who are really just starting out with budgeting. I talked to a friend of mine who's a bond trader who lost his job, and that's the number one thing that he changed to doing is go to the ATM once a week, estimate what your expenses are. You may be totally wrong. You buy stuff with cash, and once you're out, you're out.
You go to the ATM in this model once a week.
Right.
Then actually sort the cash into different budget envelopes.
Right.
That you set aside for groceries, transportation, whatever. And when the cash is gone, you know you're done for the week.
Right. Absolutely.
That is really low-tech, old-fashioned. Back to basics.
Right.
People keep posting their debt questions for you on our page.
Mm-hmm.
And my guest is Anya Kamenetz, who's been joining us every Thursday with debt advice. She's the author of Generation Debt. She writes for Fast Company. Here's one I know you found important this week, and it's an outrageous situation from TK in New Jersey.
Right.
Let's see if you can help. It says, I have a doctor's bill, which my doctor never submitted to my health insurance company. It has now been submitted to a collections agency. Health insurance company has told me it's not my fault and up to the doctor to submit the bill in a timely manner. Health insurance is not covering the bill due to late submission by the doctor. Ouch. Now I receive a monthly bill from a collections agency, which I was told to ignore by my health insurance. I've also received a letter from the health insurance submitted to the doctor stating that I'm not responsible for the bill, but this is now on my credit report. What do I do?
Okay, so I picked this question because I thought this is a really hard question, and I talked to a credit counselor, Eve Pigeon at GreenPath Debt Management, which is one of the ones that I recommended last week, and she said, you know, you got four parties here, right? You have the collections agency, you got the credit reporting bureau, then you've got your doctor and your health insurance company. It sounds like she's been talking mainly to the health insurance company, and they've been telling her, you know, they're saying two different things. They're saying, A, you're not responsible for this bill, and B, we're not responsible for this bill.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what I would recommend is, first, I think it's definitely worth talking to a debt counselor about this. But secondly, I think that you have to pay the bill, actually, if you can. I think
really?
You have to talk to collections agency, because then you can go back to the health insurance company and seek reimbursement on it, and that is a whole other case. But by paying the bill, or at least making plans to pay the bill, you can get it removed from your credit report. You can stop having the collections agency bother you. Then you're just dealing with the health insurance company and the doctor.
It seems outrageous to me, both on the part of the doctor, who never submitted the bill
right.
to the health insurance. That's the doctor's responsibility. But also on the part of the health insurance company. Because the bill doesn't come in a month or two or whatever their deadline is,
right.
then they're not going to pay it, even though it's a legitimate claim. Who makes that rule?
Well, clearly they have no standing to say that, right? If they have responsibility to pay the bill, then they have responsibility to pay the bill. I think they're just telling her whatever they can think of, you know, to try to close the case. But this is where it's good, you know, and I talked to GreenPath about when do you really want a debt counselor on your side. Someone who can intercede for you and to raise the confidence of the creditors that they're going to get their money back is really the biggest advantage.
Here's another one from V in Montclair. This one says, I just received a letter from Capital One Credit Cards advising me that my APR rate and cash advance interest rates would be increased by 50% effective in May.
Mm-hmm.
I do not carry a balance on this card and use it just a few times a year. My current APR interest rate is 8%. When I called to say that I thought that rate should stay the same or be lowered, I was advised that the only way to avoid the increase was to cancel the card. Of course, I intend to simply not use the card after it expires. It seems that canceling the card will hurt my score. My question is, do the politicians and regulators know that this is happening?
So they're trying to get rid of her and or him, and credit card companies are trying to close their accounts because all of a sudden they can see that they handed out credit cards like candy. They sent solicitations to everybody. Now everybody who's got a handful of credit cards, that represents a potential liability and default on the part of the credit card company. So they are raising rates and they are closing accounts. And what you need to do if you don't want to basically lose your credit cards, and this is happening to the good, you know, the people that don't use their cards as much, you actually need to start charging a small amount on those cards every month and paying them off, because the credit card companies need to see that those cards are in use.
Why would they think it's a bad risk if you have credit cards that are that you're not being used. It means that you have more credit than you can use.
Well, so that's true in terms of the formulas of the credit bureaus. But all of a sudden, they're saying, hey, if you have five credit cards and they each have a $10,000 limit, that's $50,000 that in a pinch, and you could lose your job, you could lose your house, and you could suddenly turn to that credit. And that is the risk that they're suddenly seeing, that they never, you know, 2 years ago, they didn't want to hear about the risk. They just want to give you a card.
Are the regulators aware, regulators? Because, you know, we're hearing all kinds. I could read you stories all day.
Yeah.
Like this one. We had another one from a guy who's paying off his balance on a regular basis, according to the rules, and more than the minimum balances that it says he has to pay off every month. And his credit card company just started slapping a $10 a month fee. Right. He says, what did I do?
Well, there's two.
This is okay?
There's two policy problems here, right? There's a credit crunch in the markets, and they are trying to apply money to the consumer credit markets, you know, and that's part of what Geithner was talking about a couple days ago, to get this flowing again, to get people willing to lend. But then you have this problem that's, you know, the credit card holders' Bill of Rights, both federal regulation as well as congressional action is trying to address, which is the unfair practices that brought us to this point.
Proposed but not passed.
Proposed but not passed regulations on the regulatory side going into effect in a year from now. And the question is, can we get those rules in place before that?
Now, you know what? We're going to take a call from Chris in Millington because he thinks he's got an answer for TK, who's been getting the collections agency after her for the doctor's bill that wasn't submitted to the health insurance company. Chris?
Yes.
Hi, you're on WNYC. You have an answer for her?
I do. Specifically, if the claim was an in-network claim, if the doctor's in the network participating in their network,
which we don't
then
know,
the claim has to be submitted within 1 year. If it's not, it is the doctor's problem, and he has to bear the burden of that. If it's out of network, all bets are off, and it's up to that person to pay the claim.
All right. So it's an in-network, out-of-network distinction.
That's a good point.
At least so says Chris. So that's something to look into. In closing out this four-part series, it seems to me there are maybe a few big themes that emerge from a lot of people's problems and your advice. Here are two that I would take away. One, the banks are out to jack up our credit card debt interest and fees any way they can right now because of their own stupid debt practices like subprime mortgages, you know. So read the fine print. And we can challenge our credit scores and negotiate with our credit companies and often get somewhere, except for student loans, one of your specialties, which usually have very rigid payback rules under federal law. All that correct?
I would say that's generally true. I think if you want to take another step back to say that, you know, I wanted to bring, you know, an optimistic tone in the going along with Obama's speech a couple nights ago, that, you know, this is a painful process, but actually what's happening in the long run, I believe, is that the credit markets are going to rationalize. Both debtors and creditors are going to realize that this is a social contract. When you take out a loan, you know, you're going to have to pay it back. On the lender side, they have to assess risk. And the reason I like this peer-to-peer idea, going back to that, is it's really a very old idea that you have a social contract between a debtor and a lender, and they're part of the same community. They should understand each other and know each other. You know, we're going towards a world of maybe less credit, maybe smarter credit, and maybe more fair.
I read something about American Express paying customers to pay off their credit card debt in 2 months. Do you know about that?
So basically, again, they're trying to lower the number of credit cards they have out there. They're trying to close accounts. And they decided that they want to improve their image because, I mean, American Express are really supposed to be like a good credit card company. And so they're going to pay you $300 if you close your account. And this is an account that's underused or unused because they want to contract the number of, you know, liabilities they have out there, but they want to leave you with a good taste in your mouth.
It's really through the looking glass world, isn't it, compared to a year ago or the whole 90s where the credit card companies, at least this one, is paying you to not have their card anymore.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That's amazing. And you said you wanted to leave with some good news. You probably saw on the front page of the business section of the Times today the article about student loans, which said that even though these rules are very rigid for paying back and you can't get out of your loan, even if you declare bankruptcy, things like that, that the federal government at the end of Bush committed a lot of money to pick up the private student loan guarantees. So there's almost every student loan now, well, student loans are very available,
right,
and they're almost all federally guaranteed.
That's true. I mean, the federal guarantee is a guarantee for the lender and not for the student. So, you know, it's not so much a consumer guarantee. But the fact is that the way that the both the Education Department and the Treasury Department have acted in the student loan market is a little bit of a model, because they haven't given money away without saying, let's make sure that, you know, the money continues to go to students.
All right. Before we go away and say goodbye, I just want to promote something that our listeners might want to do for a segment that we'll be doing in about 15 minutes. Jonah Lehrer, no relation, the guy behind Proust Was a Neuroscientist, his new book is about how we make decisions. And we're collecting posts on our webpage. What's the most irrational decision you've ever made, and did it work out? Because he's all about when rational decisions are smart and when irrational decisions are smart. And he says sometimes irrational decisions are smart, even in certain kinds of investments. So we'll get Jonah Lehrer's take on that coming up in about 15 minutes. But what's the most irrational decision you ever made, and did it work out? Post those stories to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Anya Kamenetz, again, this has been so helpful. Our listeners have been really appreciating the personal advice, but also the context of the political consciousness that you bring to all this. People really appreciate that, too. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ryan.
You can follow Anya Kamenetz on Fast Company, on her blog, The Narrow Bridge, at Yahoo Finance, Generation Debt, and her book, Generation Debt. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.